Welcome to the Phoenix Cast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John,
Rich,
and Kyle.
Rich and I are both U.S. Marines, and the opinions expressed on the cast are those of the host, not official military policy. The opinions expressed by Kyle are his own, not his employer or any other business he's associated with. For today's episode, no special guest, just the host talking it out.
So we were supposed to have a really awesome special guest this week, but as you can imagine, life's crazy for lots of people in lots of ways right now. So we're going to go ahead and pull an audible today. The special guest is going to come on in the next couple of weeks, and we're still going to keep that topic going. But we decided, when in doubt, adapt and overcome in the true Marine Corps fashion. So we said, what should we talk about today? And we are all very passionate about many things in this world we call technology. So today's topic, and buckle your seatbelts, is going to be Zero Trust, Beyond Corp, and all things next generation security models. So I feel quite passionately about this. I currently work for the company that developed Beyond Corp, and I have implemented many Zero Trust models for customers and personally. And I hear that there are some rumblings inside the Marine Corps, John and Rich, about this very topic. Is that true?
I think it's definitely fair to say that almost everything that's new and interesting is on the lips of the Marine Corps, and we are always looking at what the next thing is. So I'm super excited to talk about this, and I think Rich actually has a bit more experience in this area than I do.
Yeah, so Rich, you want to go ahead and what is Zero Trust / Beyond Corp in a couple sentences or less? I know that may be a difficult challenge.
Yeah, no, I mean, my leg is shaking. Like, I'm at the starting line. So thanks, guys. But yeah, so what's Zero Trust, right? So a Zero Trust model is based upon treating everything as though it's externally facing, right? Internet facing, because you assume that your entire network architecture to be compromised is something that you want to ride over top of as a transport method, but you're going to do it in a secure way by implementing all these controls along the line to get you closer to the data layer and closer to the actual user and the user's identity. So you're securing the data and the identities to get access to the resources that you require, but you just flat out assume that your network is completely compromised. So why, right, is the big question. And this is based upon Operation Aurora. So for those who don't know what Operation Aurora is, it happens to be that nation state actors targeted U.S. companies, specifically companies like Google and higher end tech organizations, and were able to compromise portions of their architecture to drive them to a point that they had to say, you know what, we're really looking at this perimeter-based security model as the thing that's going to save us. And you know what? It just isn't. Why? Because it did not, right? So Zero Trust really focuses on having zero trust, as the name implies, in your network architectures so that you could start to figure out what are the better controls, right? Things like building in strong authentication, authorization, encryption throughout your end-to-end system and its life cycles, right? And then providing compartmentalized access in order to gain kind of better agility. And what I mean by agility is what we've seen in the public sector, and Kyle has definitely had experience with this, and so has John, is folks are able to access the resources they need when they need them from the platforms that are easiest for them to utilize and are a little more native and ubiquitous to them. So what I mean by that is, you know, can I get access to a corporate resource from my personal mobile device, right? Why not? We as technology professionals should be enabling that for our user base so that they can do work when and where they feel most comfortable and what's most efficient and effective to deliver a business goal. And I guess the last thing I'll say before I turn it back over to the group is, what better time than now to focus on, hey, we are doing business over the internet right now because we are so focused on telework because of the nature of the global pandemic. Why would we not focus on the security controls that enable our users to get work done efficiently, but not care upon what transport they use to get to those resources because we have the right mechanisms in place to allow them to do work securely? So sorry, guys, for that rant. But like I said, my leg was shaking, and I'm super passionate, as you guys hear. But back to the group.
Yeah, so let me add a couple things to that too. So, you know, Rich just dove pretty deeply into this topic, and let me pull back to about a 5,000 foot view and to say, you know, historically what we've always done is we said, hey, drop a firewall in this or build a DMZ with some honeypots, and we've made really strong walls around our castle. The problem with that is if someone gets inside your castle, if you have the, you know, stereotypical Trojan horse scenario, when someone gets in, we usually have much more lackadaisical security on the inside of those walls. So people have these really beefy, strong firewalls with all these, you know, firewall rules and access controls and authentication mechanisms. But once you're in, what's to stop service A from talking to service B? And the problem that we ran into with this, like we talked about with Operation Aurora, is that if you can compromise those very difficult things, then you kind of have access to many, many, many other things that you wouldn't previously. So it's a very high value target. Whereas if you move to a zero trust model, you basically trust nothing. And therefore, every target is only as good as itself. You can't necessarily find any sort of master key in a zero trust model, which opens up a bunch of weird opportunities that I know we're going to talk about here in a second about new ways that you can use security. But just it's important to realize this is pretty much a opposite end of the spectrum of the traditional set up a firewall and the firewall is your security perimeter for all the things sentimentality. This is sort of newish and it's a little more complicated, but it has a much better security footprint.
Yeah. So Kyle, I'm going to jump in here because I mentioned Operation Aurora, you referred to it. So I just kind of want to catch the listeners up to what we mean there if they're not familiar, right? So Operation Aurora was a series of cyber attacks, right? Or intrusions, I'll just say, by what folks like Mandiant have binned or bucketed into what they refer to as advanced persistent threats, or people hear them refer to as APTs. And that was back in 2009 to 2010 timeframe. So Google kind of publicly disclosed that they were having issues around the beginning of 2010, when really some of these attacks were beginning probably mid-2009. And you know, it was a series of attacks that were thought to come from the People's Liberation Army, right? Or spaces in China. And those attacks were aimed at like other organizations. So like Adobe, Akamai, Juniper, Rackspace, they've all kind of confirmed that, yeah, they believe they were targeted, right? And as we all know, attribution is wickedly hard. In this space.
Wickedly hard. This is all rumor and conjecture.
Exactly, right. But I mean, this is stuff you could go Wikipedia, you can just ironically Google, right, to search. But I just kind of wanted to catch you know, the listeners up. If you're not familiar with Operation Aurora, really good place to start your reading if you're thinking about what motivated people to come up with a zero trust model. Moving forward to kind of move their perimeters, as Kyle mentioned, away from the castle moat perimeter defense mentality into how can we secure things inside of that space and then also do things like challenge people when they need higher elevated permissions to things, which we'll probably talk about later in this conversation. So yeah, back out to the group.
Yeah. So John, you had mentioned a conversation that you'd had this week around this topic. You want to bring us up to speed on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was kind of one of the things of like, hey, you know, as we're evaluating what we're doing operationally day to day, it's a good idea to just stop and ask yourself, what is industry doing? What are the trends there generally look like? And if we decided to go in that direction, the complete way that industry went is essentially everything that we're doing now a sunken cost. And so it's important to kind of look at, hey, if we pivoted completely, are the things we're buying and the actions we're taking the wrong thing to do? So that's definitely something we took a hard look at and wanted to make sure in the realm of like, hey, if we wanted to go zero trust, or are we doing the types of things that make sense to do right now? I think you had an awesome analogy of the medieval castle, and I think everybody understands that. Can one of the group members here though kind of give us a awesome concept? What would that look like? So, you know, if you're going to not focus on the perimeter, or you're going to shift to the data and the access, what's it actually mean to defend in that way? Give us an example or how you'd maybe change a couple of things.
Yeah. Kyle, do you mind if I jump in here real quick and what kind of start?
Oh, no, sir. No, sir. Age before beauty, please.
Thank you so much. By the way, for those who don't know, Kyle is way more beautiful than I. But having said that,
and your running joke of this, the running joke.
But yeah, having kind of prefaced all that, I think, you know, to John's point, right? This, what do we mean by like moving away from a network perimeter defense posture? Well, let's start with segmentation, right? So I want to have a quick conversation about kind of the purpose of your network and what your networks do and why they were created, right? So a lot of organizations create a corporate network so that their corporate user base can actually do work and collaborate, right? A lot of us now are kind of seeing that come to fruition with different collaboration tools, whether using Adobe Connect during the COVID, you know, crisis or some other series of tools like that. Microsoft Teams is very popular, right? Any collaboration suite of tools like the G Suite that you could use from a Google perspective, they're all out there, right? Like Amazon has their Chime and different kind of solutions that they provide as well. And you can go on down the line. But my point here is that, you know, a corporate network kind of exists now to allow your user base to collaborate with each other, work on products that allow intellectual property development so that they can help move the business forward on its business goals, right? And then you had a part of your corporate network in the past that would run production services or systems, right? And that kind of got pulled away from the user land area that we just talked about with collaboration into what people generally refer to as a production network. Where are the things that are customer facing that serve your customers, no matter what they are? If you're a manufacturing company, you would want to have a network built for your manufacturing systems that wasn't attached to the network that your internal corporate users operate on. Why? Because humans generally introduce risk to those systems, whether by malice or just by ignorance, and not ignorance in a bad way. They just might not know they're introducing risk. So I kind of wanted to start this conversation about around zero trust, talking about how do we segment risk or areas of risk based upon network profiles before we start getting away into the depths and the awesomeness that is like strong authentication or data level protection, because it's really just a good thing if you're looking at zero trust to start segmenting your networks, or what people refer to nowadays as micro segmentation, to get risk buckets so that like risks are contained together and they don't kind of blend into each other. So I think right now the DoD, as they go through this transformation on how are we going to look at telework, we really need a network segmented for our user base so that they could go do user things, and anything in user land that's risky doesn't get kind of carried over into production land. You know, and from a DoD perspective, those systems are meant for national defense, right? So you have this conversation between a business system, AKA user land and things like that, or a national defense system, which is kind of production land, because those are the things we're using to, you know, protect the good guys and do bad things to bad people when required. So we need to kind of segment those things. So Kyle, I'll kind of toss it over to you. Does that make sense? I mean, just to start the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, from a DoD perspective, this is an easy concept to understand just because we already have that in place, right? We've got different classification levels of information, and you can only access certain bits of information from certain classification level systems, et cetera. What we're talking about here is expanding that down to another level. So within, let's just go ahead and use, you know, the NIPR, the unclassed network. How much of what you do inside of that network is sensitive work? And how much of you do inside of that is administrative work? How much of that is, you know, and when I say administrative in this case, I mean, you know, user administration or network administration. And how much of it is just everyday email, chat, you know, PowerPoint that makes us all smarter, as we all know, right, John? And how do you break that down? Bucketing things by risk is actually much more tricky than it seems for most civilian companies. Judging what is sensitive and what is not is a bit tricky depending on the industry that you're in, the vertical you're in. And like we said, you know, when your mission is to make money, a lot of things get easier than when your mission is to defend a nation. So, Rich, when you talk about doing the risk management, can you give us some examples of how you would maybe subclassify some of the stuff on any particular network?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Kyle. So from a risk perspective, right, I think what I'm talking about here is that we have systems that are required to actually conduct the business of the military, right? Whether that's a logistics system, right, where you have to get beans, bullets, bombs, band-aids to military personnel in either austere climates forward, or let's just say for humanitarian assistance or disaster recovery in response to some national pandemic. Go figure if that ever occurred, right? So those systems by themselves have to have such a high level of availability because they would affect immediately operations if an adversary was to get in there and change the nature of how those systems operate, right? So if you couldn't trust those systems, it would kind of be wickedly hard to have a high level of trust to know this thing that I ordered from a logistics perspective is going to show up at the time and place it's required, right? And what I would not want to do is kind of take risks that are associated with, for example, a user sending emails back and forth or doing video conferences with folks and kind of blend those buckets together. So I guess my point in here without ranting is I kind of generally tend to bucket risks into what is the nature of the software that you're trying to operate in the data that the software is processing, and look at risk from that perspective to an operation instead of just putting all the users and all the applications and all the data on one flat monolithic network that if penetrated, right, would allow people to kind of the ability to move across that network and kind of pick and choose what things that they wanted to alter that maybe may mess up the CIA triad, whether it's confidentiality, integrity, or availability of the system. So does that make sense, Kyle?
Yeah. And the way you described it there was actually really interesting, where you don't want to put it all into one monolithic structure, right? And that's the whole point of this. We don't want to build big castles. We want super duper tiny micro castles, but each one's got its own, you know, we're going to use bad metaphors here, but you know, each one's got its own moat and drawbridge and, you know, archers on the roof or whatever you want to call it. And the smaller you can make each of these castles, with the more robust you can make the security, the level of effort required to compromise any system is higher, and the level of effort needed to compromise multiple systems is literally exponentially higher.
Yeah. And I could add here also, you know, you hit on some really important points there. The two big things I think Kyle said, you know, it's easy to say, classify things into bins. It's harder to do that. So I think definitely adding either some level of automation or extremely simple binning system to do that's really important, because you can put all the moats around things you want to, but if we haven't properly said this is something that's important, no moat around it. So that's super important to remember. And then the other thing too is, you know, we do have some uniquely military things, kind of like Rich talked about. And if you put together our weapons with our beans, bullets, and band-aids and the current levels that we had and where we had them, you know, you could aggregate a bunch of somewhat meaningless information together into something that was incredibly important. That's definitely something we always consider. But we do have the standard concerns that anybody's going to have from any industry, really, right? You know, because we have to pay people. So there's sensitivity around how much money are you sending, where are you sending it, the personal information around there. We have a health system with inside the military, so we want to be really careful about HIPAA-related type things. And the personal information outside of around pay, you know, that's something that we have to keep in mind as well. So we have some of the standard concerns that any industry is going to have.
Yeah, so John, yes, I completely agree that we have very similar, you know, problems and challenges we need to tackle. And I think, Kyle, to even be more simplistic in answering your question earlier about risk, right? It's to me, I think folks generally get very, 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 very ingrained. That's probably the wrong word, but like they overly immerse themselves. That's better. In trying to like measure the risk, right? So like to come up with all these algorithms to say like, hey, you know, here's my risk algorithm, right? Like impact plus, you know, a vulnerability equals blah, right? And what I'm trying to say is like, instead of trying
I'm having flashbacks of the ORM matrix that I had to live and die by, right?
It's like, not pretty. Totally. It not
pretty. Yes.
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, to your point about micro segmentation and building many, many tiny little castles with their own moat and their own drawbridge, right, to give access and authorization through, I think that's the point we're trying to make, right, is that if you contain the risk for a specific application or specific users into very, very small bubbles, right, then if one of those bubbles are punctured, the other bubbles don't get punctured, right? It's just exactly that bubble, and that bubble doesn't affect the other bubbles. And I think that's what we're trying to say. So I guess I think I just said tiny bubbles everywhere, right? And then you get to a space where you're like, you're comfortable with talking about risk. And the actual measurement of it, that comes over time. Like you're saying, it's non-trivial to come up with a risk algorithm that compares apples to apples across your enterprise for both production and corporate systems. But I think if you start looking at, hey, I'm going to build something and I'm going to contain the risk for that thing only to that thing, and I don't want it to affect other things, that I think then becomes a very zero trust like mindset, right? Where you're like, hey, I'm not going to trust what anybody else does or how they connect to me over a transport network. I'm going to make sure that every time they come through my moat over the drawbridge, right, it's on my standards with my security protocols, my authorization and authentication mechanisms. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So if we take this risk model, and actually before I transition slightly here, John, anything you want to add to that?
No, that's great. Keep going, please.
So then, Rich, let's just go ahead and assume that we've done this incredibly hard thing of identifying our risks, right, and categorizing our risk networks. So now what's the next step in the process? Now that we've got those categorized, what's the beauty of Zero Trust for me?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? So I think what happens now is you're almost kind of, dare I say, shoehorning yourself into the Zero Trust model into what most folks would refer to colloquially as a service-oriented architecture, right? Where now your systems connect to each other through things like application programmer interfaces or some other interfaces where they have to pass all the sniff tests to get in and out from those bubbles of risk, right? Or those bubbles of application homes, if I could put it that way, right? So then you start to move to, oh, okay, well, what is that actual security control going to be, right? And I think a lot of folks start to think, how am I authenticating right now, right? Is a username and password a really good way to do that? Even if I have two-factor auth, is that great? Like, I bet sometimes people could probably get a hold of a couple factors if they really did the research. So why don't I just, based upon my classification of risk, right, that we just kind of magically fairy dusted away and said, we now know top to tail 1 to N what the risk profile is for each of these apps. Why don't we just start challenging people as they try to get to these more riskier sets of data that are being processed by these apps in these tiny bubbles? So I think that's where Zero Trust takes you next, right? Once you get past micro segmentation, you start to think about, okay, I now have a very small risk bucket, but how do I let people through it? And I think that's where all the goodness comes from modern day strong authentication. So kind of kick it back to you, Kyle and John, to talk about strong auth and challenging and why that's important in relation to Zero Trust.
Well, so let me do this really quick. So Rich, before we dive into what I would like to call the super nerd areas of Zero Trust, I want to TLDR what you just said. So let's go ahead and assume that you've got this risk strategy figured out and you've got your stuff put in place and you've got your security models and you've built your castles around all your microservices. Well, now you have a bunch of different options that you can do for escalation. It's the what you know, what you have, you know, all those multi-factor of authentications, but you also have a lot of information about the client, like where they're coming from. So the sort of nirvana location that we want to get to is we want to be able to say, hey, is this user on an authorized device using their multi-factor token or whatever that's going to end up being and coming from a corporate network, meaning They're in the office on an office device with their authenticated mechanism. Well, what do they have access to? Well, now you have the freedom to say, well, they have access to everything maybe, or maybe they only have access to X, Y, or Z until they auth with a different method. But let's say that that same user now is logging in from their personal computer at home in, you know, Virginia or Maryland or wherever that they're coming from. Well, now they still have access to some things, but you can now lock down and say, well, they don't have access to other specific, maybe highly sensitive information. And then we can take this another step further and say, well, now what if that user is logging in from a country overseas? Well, now we can lock them down even more and even maybe flag their traffic for deeper inspection because it's just highly suspect. Especially you can start to do behavioristics and other, you know, logging and monitoring activities to say, well, this user logged in this morning in Virginia, but logged in this afternoon from, I don't know, South Africa or, you know, Europe or the Middle East or Asia, like somewhere where it doesn't make sense that they would log in from. Well, now we've got a bunch of good information that we can use to track this down. So this is the nirvana that we're trying to get to, where BeyondCorp and zero trust environments start to become the ultra sexy thing that everyone talks about in conferences and on videos and in the documentation. But now we've got all these things under the hood that we've got to get to. So I'm going to pass over to John for strong auth because he's going to explain it better than I ever can. But just keep that in mind, oh, listeners who are out there, that that's what we're trying to get to here.
Yeah, absolutely. I did want to toss one thing in before we move on from there, just to add to what Kyle was saying about the nirvana. The nirvana happens because we've measured so many things. And just a couple things to kind of make it like, how is this different than what we're currently doing or what people are used to? You know, all the stuff Kyle said about, you know, is it from your work domain or from your home and things like that. You can also nail it down to, is that the same computer that he normally logs onto this specific system with?
Right.
And you have a general idea of a profile of John generally logs on here between 08 and 09 and kind of generally accesses this information, you know, this amount of bits, et cetera. That's getting wickedly specific. And then if you vary from that, it can either be flag or ask for extra auth. So yeah, just kind of wanted to add in that in there a little bit. But to be honest, I am not the super SME of strong auth. I'm going to toss that back over the fence.
So
Rich gets to ask the question and answer it. This is the perfect podcast.
He likes it better that way anyways.
Oh, snap. Yeah. So let's talk about strong authentication for a second, right? And we'll just kind of go through the evolution of how users can authenticate, which is step one, and then get authorized, which is step two, to a resource on a network, right? So in the past, authentication was very something I knew, right? I knew a password and I had an account. And every time the account, which represented my identity, right, would try to connect to a thing, I had to type in a thing I knew, which was my password, right? Now, humans are humans, right? So one, they like habit, which means they generally tend to repeat passwords across different accounts. So if I do get it compromised, I could probably use the same password to multiple services to get access if I'm a threat actor, right? And then two, you know, they generally tend to not remember long strings of numbers, AKA is the wrong phrase, but introduce the domain naming system, right? So instead of typing a bunch of numbers in an octet and colon a port or protocol, I can actually type words that humans remember, like www.google.com, right? Instead of a string of numbers, which I actually identify the IP address for that device. So the point I'm trying to make here is that in order to, one, make it more secure than just something I knew, we came up with a couple different factors, which is what multi-factor authentication is, something I know, not only something I know, but something I have, or then something I am, like a biometric. Those three things kind of coupled together, plus other types of authentication or challenging, are what is commonly referred to in the modern day as strong authentication. Why? Because it's more effective than just one method or even two methods of authentication factors, if that makes sense. So from a strong authentication perspective, that's really what we're trying to do in order to make sure somebody can prove that they are who they say they are, or more directly stated, I have an identity that's an abstraction of me in a system, right? I have to prove that I'm that identity. So I use strong authentication mechanisms to do that. And every time I gain access to a more risky system, like we talked about before, something that's more critical to the business operation of my organization, I might even get challenged to provide those credentials again, just to make sure that I am who I say I am, even though I did it minutes previously, right? So anyhow, that's kind of what I'm referring to when I say strong authentication. Kyle, would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's use examples of this because this is perfect. So I log into my Gmail account, right? And I use a username and a password, not necessarily strong authentication. But if I have my virtual device multi-factor authentication 6-digit code that's delivered to my phone, Rich, is that strong authentication to you?
It's stronger. Absolutely. Yeah,
excellent. Excellent. And so,
and how did that get delivered? That is the question.
Yeah, we'll get there in a second. Hold on. I'm going to get there, John, I promise. So then, Rich, you also have this cool thing called the Common Access Card that you're using to log on every day at your work. Do you not? Is that strong or stronger?
So it's stronger in the sense that I have something, which is my card, and then a set of certificates on it. And I know a thing that allows me to unlock that certificate. But is that the only two things I want to do to get to highly sensitive data? I would say we could get stronger.
And how would you get stronger then? What other things do you have on here? Are we talking biometrics? Are we talking just using both of those things? So I've got my CAT card and someone sends me an SMS text with a 6-digit code?
Yeah, so absolutely. Kyle, keep hitting me with the jabs here because I love this, right? I'm going to use an example and give some props where some credit's due, right? So Microsoft came out, a few years ago with something called Microsoft Hello, right? Which was allowing you to use something you are, a biometric, like a facial scan, to log into your laptop, right? So let's say I had my CAT card inserted into my GFE, my government furnished equipment, right? In this case, it's a laptop. And I have my CAT card, which is something I have, my PIN, which is something I know. But when I open up the laptop, the camera on that laptop does a retinal scan, but a facial scan, and says, yep, that's Rich. And now I have three things, right? Which is even stronger than the two things that was my CAT card, right? So yes, we can keep going down this path. So Kyle, what's the next jab? Hit me with it.
No, I'm setting this up correctly. So then we want to talk about each of those things. So there was some very early publicized not greatness around facial recognition when like the iPhone 10 first launched, and then patches came out and things got better. And to John's point earlier, when we talk about, a lot of people are now very familiar with this 6-digit code or 8-digit code or whatever it's going to be that's delivered, right? When you log into most banking institutions, or you can set this up inside of your Gmail account, your Office 365 account, which is just that device access code, many names for the same thing. But there's a lot of ways that thing gets delivered, right? SMS is the most common option that I see in the outside world, where someone will send you a text message, right? Banks do this all the time, with the right code for you to access. So John, really quickly, your thoughts on the trust levels of SMS messaging and text messages?
Yeah, I would go as far as to say not as trustworthy.
Correct. That is the right answer.
You do need a reasonable, there's a reasonable amount of complexity, right? So if you're just logging on to your Gmail and you log on and you do that, I think that's pretty good, for like a personal email standpoint. Mm-hmm. Like, it'd be nice to be better, but I mean, if that's what you're doing to, say, be able to make $100,000+ transfers from your bank account, maybe I don't feel as good about that.
Yeah. And it's important to understand that, like, and we're not going to dive into the details of this, like, SMS messaging is pretty easy to spoof. I won't say it's like child's play, but if you know what you're doing, it can be absolutely done. You can spoof any kind of message like that. A virtual device. Exactly. The man in the middle attack in particular. So lots of different ways that's troublesome. So just if you, the user, is out there and you notice that you have choices in this space where it's like, would you like to use SMS or would you like to use a virtual device or hardware device? You should always try to use the most secure method that whatever company is out there is offering you. So now that we've decided that we like more things, right? Like a username, a password, a 6-digit code that goes to a virtual device, and a facial recognition. So now let's say we've solved strong auth. What's next in the kitty, Rich?
So I think then we start to talk about this overall, what we call zero trust architecture, right? It's not just authentication, right? It's not just micro segmentation of your networks or the applications within those networks that cloud gives you like an awesome ability to do, right? Whether you're in a VPC in Amazon or a tenant in Microsoft, you know, we can keep going with all the cloud service offering buckets of network segmentation. But I think what's super important here is to talk about the overall zero trust reference architecture or reference architectures that are out there, right? So in theory, when you start talking about zero trust, you have to start talking about a device inventory service, right? That, you know, as you mentioned earlier, Kyle, like if I'm on my corporate network and I have a device that's been inventoried by my organization, it's been issued potentially a certificate that's protected inside of like a TPM chip on the motherboard that I have to unlock, right, as part of this whole authentication mechanism in order to authenticate to some resource, right, off my corporate network or even from a public network. I have a high level, I won't say high level, but a stronger probability that that device is something I issued my user. And then the user goes through all the strong authentication mechanisms you talked about on top of the physical device, right? All of that, specifically the device, needs to be kind of inventoried in an inventory service, right? So that anytime that device tries to access a network resource, it gets to the second kind of this part of the zero trust architecture, which is an access control mechanism or proxy, right? So that access control mechanism looks at that device and says, yes, you have factors that allow me to grant you access. Then you as the user using that device also provide your factors to authenticate on top of that. And okay, now I have a higher level of trust that this device is something I own. The user using it is someone who is part of my organization. But even more so, when we talk about risk, now that device actually has to be assessed, right? The security state of that device has to be looked at to say, are you running on the most patched version of your operating system? Whether it's a laptop, right? Running a Windows operating system like most of the DoD uses, or, you know, it's a mobile device. Like, are you on the latest version of iOS if you're an iPhone user, or the latest version of Android OS if you're an Android user, right? So I guess what I'm trying to say here is that the zero trust architecture is not just about the user, right, in their forms of authentication, but the model takes into account that I actually know what devices I've issued out to people because I have a service that inventories them. And then I also have a service that allows me to ensure that I'm assessing the state of that device and that user identity, no matter where they're at, because I might not want to give them access to things that are risky from our earlier risk talk from my business portfolio if they're not on all of the highest patch levels I want them to be on. That doesn't mean they can't have access to some basic things like John mentioned, like email, right? But it definitely means they can't get into my code repo, right, where all of my corporate knowledge and my intellectual property exists. So I'll pause there because I covered a lot. And Kyle, feel free to unpack that, you or John. But that's kind of, I want to talk about the architecture versus just kind of talking about how we authenticate, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I'll say this to all the listeners at home too. We're getting into the weeds on this a little bit, which is great. But if you are looking out there to do some own research on your own, just go to your favorite search engine and type in Zero Trust or Beyond Corp, and you will find a number of very cool articles and research papers that have been published by a lot of places. You know, for prepping for this call, we looked at pretty much Google's research paper on Beyond Corp, which is a great little, I think it's 15-page document, you know, light reading for all of you tech wizards out there. Go look at that because it's going to outline a lot in more detail what we're talking about here. So let me double click on what you said there, Rich, about, you know, your device inventory. And in the talk, we focused a lot on the end user device, right? Your workstation, your laptop. But when you're talking about zero trust across the board, it's important to realize all devices fit into this category, right? Your network devices, your border gateway devices, your user termination devices, all your internal systems as well can take advantage of that sort of system. And then the burden on you becomes, how do you track all of the things across all of your things?
Yes. Yeah. And I think too, as well, you know, again, to talk about earlier what you covered, Kyle, kind of at the beginning of our conversation about, you know, where we're going, right? Like, what is the end goal we're trying to achieve here, right? And as the name implies, you want to place zero trust in the network you're trying to use as a means to get to a resource that you would then either strongly authenticate and have high authorization models built in for. So I think it's important to know that, like, the purpose of doing a lot of this stuff, and some companies call it externalization, right? They want to make, and I guess I'll just phrase this a little differently. And Kyle and John, tell me if you disagree with me on this perspective. But in my experience, when folks are building, or in the past would build, a corporate application that they knew was going to be on their corporate network and not meant to be exposed to customers or outside of their organizational trust boundaries, right? Like the ClickWheel firewall that the entire organization is behind. Like, we're not going to expose this thing outside of that. So it's kind of okay to do things a little scrappier, a little faster. And maybe we don't invest a whole bunch of, like, resources, whether that's money, people, time, into really hardening those things. Because we should be really focused on the things that are customer facing. They're going to be outside of that trust zone or outside of that corporate firewall, which made a lot of sense to folks until they realized that threat actors were inside of the castle walls, right? Grabbing all of their intellectual property and siphoning it out. And so I think it's important for us to kind of pause for a second and say, what we're doing here is normalizing out, securing corporate resources, just like we would secure those that are customer facing, because our customers, right, would never want us to scrimp or, like, scrape the lowest barrel, right, of security. They would want to make sure that that security bar is high. And I think when you're talking about defense systems, right, a really good recent analogy that's kind of like a good visual in people's brains is SpaceX. Right. So if I'm that astronaut that's sitting in the Dragon capsule on top of that rocket, right, that is the first private sector delivered transport vehicle that's going to deliver a payload of human beings to the moon, right, or to the space station, the International Space Station.
Moon's coming. They're not there yet.
They're not yet. Yeah. But the International Space Station, right? So my point here is that I would want to make sure that those systems that operate the network that launched that payload and those astronauts into space, right, are super secure. And I would also want to make sure that anybody working tangentially on the intellectual property that's helping me build that stuff, even though I've separated those two networks, like we talked about earlier, like the rocket network and the user network, I would want to make sure that user network is super secure too. And not really think that my network perimeter defenses are going to be the thing I rely upon. So I don't know if that makes sense, but I really think this SpaceX, you know, kind of mental model is kind of something that's really visual into people's brains, especially if you're the astronaut sitting on the end of that rocket. You would want to make sure that the things that built the rocket were not at the lowest bidder, and that the network security also wasn't done in a way that was like, yeah, well, we're going to scrimp on this area in order to focus on something else. So I'll end my rant there for now.
Yeah, and once you build these sort of security models for, like, HTTP applications, it gets easy to spread them to other applications, right? Once you've got the infrastructure in place to secure a HTTP app, it's much easier to secure most of the HTTP apps in a similar manner. And you get your lessons learned done through, you know, an initial POC and then some first mover, you know, applications, and then you can spread from there. So you don't, it's not a big bang, right? You don't have to support this right away. Most customers and companies that I see implementing this model do so in a very gradual rolled out method. And then, you know, at the end of this entire thing, they basically shut off their VPN servers and their border firewalls and no one noticed. And that's how you can tell they did it right, is that it's not impacting anybody at that point. So important to understand that you don't have to start huge on this. You can start small and it scales up. And exactly what you said, you know, every one of those systems should be at the most secure you can make it. And you can always default to most secure once you have those frameworks in place and those different risk categories in place. And then as you decide that the risk is more acceptable, you can lower the barrier of entry for those identification and authentication methods.
The thing that's really funny about all that is if you would have told 5 or 10 years ago, maybe not five, but 5 or 10 years ago, John, hey, walk into a room and say, I'm going to turn off the firewalls and the VPNs. I think that's probably the quickest way to give aneurysm to the largest audience, especially if you're in a security room, right? Because these are not words that we would take lightly or concepts. Like the idea to let the listenership know is like, this is a serious major shift in not only how you secure, but really, and I think Kyle was kind of getting to it, the way that you think about operating your systems. Because if you think about how your systems operate, you think about what information is important and how they interact. And then that kind of gets you to what you need to secure in what order, to Kyle's point of like, you don't have to do it all in day one, but you do need to think differently. And that's, you know, not every single one of these things is a technical solution necessarily, although there certainly will be some technical solutions and you'll need to do things differently, but you need to think differently also. And I don't think we should overlook that.
Absolutely. And I mean, going back in time and comparing, you know, what my expectations were is a great example of this, where it takes a big mental shift to do this. Like 2 years ago, I thought that my username, my password, and a multi-factor authentication token and having like a corporate asset was the pinnacle of security. Just, I hadn't, you know, been exposed to more. And now when I go to work every day, I obviously have a username and password because that's like the ubiquitous thing. And I have many thoughts and opinions we can get into in another episode about passwords, but I basically have an auth token that I carry around with me, and that lets me into the basic stuff. And if I'm on a corporate asset, I get into more stuff, and I don't worry about my laptop. If it gets run over by a truck tomorrow, I just go get a new one off the shelf and I'm back up and running in like literally 10 seconds. It's nothing. And if I need to get access to something sensitive and I'm not at the office, I just go to the office and do it. Or I can launch a cloud-based desktop, connect to that, and then connect in, because that's launched in the office. There's all these really interesting ways where, as long as you're making it easy on your user to accomplish their day-to-day job, like, that sort of makes everything behind the scenes a lot more simplistic also. But you can't do that if your synapses in your brain are stuck in like firewall, secure the border, like trust nobody outside mentality. You've got to shift that. And exactly what you said, John, you got to think a little different in this and expand your horizon a little bit. You know, OODA loop, head in a swivel, plus plus to all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the nice thing is, we talked about this earlier about everything being about measurement. You don't, for the most part, need to buy a bunch of extra stuff you don't already have. You know, Kyle talked about getting rid of firewalls and VPN servers. But if you think about all the different systems you have on your network, all the information that you need is generally there already. You really just need to think smartly about how you're going to access that, what systems, you know, need to be able to grab that information to make decisions. But, you know, I don't think it's a lot about, you know, you better find, you know, the newest version of a company that's got the new hotness that's going to finally get you to zero trust, so that, you know, with the low, low figure of, you know, insert your X million or billion dollars here, we can do this. It'd be surprising how much of this stuff you kind of have already.
Right. If you're willing to put the work in with the data you already have, you can probably do this with little to no out-of-pocket cost. Now, don't get me wrong, there are plenty of companies out there that would gladly take your money to provide the service for you, right? Like pretty much all the hyperscale cloud providers have some version of this already that you can, you know, it's not quite as easy as add to cart, but you can get a lot of the benefits of the framework within it. But it's the system's only as good as the metrics that you're tracking and the behavior that you are aware of, right? You have to be able to have identities and personas and understand the gates and the risk factors that are going to be used to qualify and, you know, match who gets what access to what resource from what location and what device with what identity. That was a long sentence, but you get the point here. That's the real hard work and heavy lifting of this. And then just sifting through the noise, right? We've talked about that in previous episodes. You have all the data you need, I promise, right? Like, go ahead and change my mind on that. You have all the data you need. The question is finding the needles in the haystacks.
Yep. And the other thing is the consistency with which you implement all the stuff Kyle said and the consistency with which you do that.
Yep.
Because that is, it seems like I'm reading a new, and Rich was like loudly giggling at work this week when we heard of yet another company who left yet another thing unsecured, you know, and it's like awesome security here and here and here and here, and whoops, you know, there's another thing, and it's almost giggle worthy at this point that it, you know, the millions and millions that are spent on all of these different systems, and essentially the equivalent of you forgetting to lock your car on your way into the house is yep. normally the way that these really bad things happen.
And you're absolutely right. Like all of this stuff we're talking about today, Zero Trust, BeyondCorp, you know, Strong Auth, all these things, security is a wide spectrum. It's a large battlefield. And just like the terrible cliches say, you know, your chain's only as strong as your weakest link. If you leave a S3 bucket open to the world and you put sensitive stuff in it, like all the best Zero Trust, BeyondCorp, DevOps, SRE, you know, insert your ML and AI buzzword here, all that stuff doesn't matter. It's all about making sure that across the board, you've got a baseline, that you have the governance in place, that you have the testing in place, that you have the rule sets that don't allow you to do really dumb things. And that's a lot easier said than done.
Yeah. So guys, I mean, I can't agree more, you know, with what you guys are saying here. And I think, you know, our listeners are probably like, hey man, these guys are really talking what gets me excited. So I'm going to go do research on my own, kind of pull all this stuff together and kind of figure out what internally I can do with the resources I have to get more towards a zero trust architecture, right? But I think that's kind of worth us kind of having a quick conversation on, not the intricates of the how, but just what are some things you probably should do as an organization to help start shifting the cultural mindset and the actions that set you up for adopting a zero trust architecture? To Kyle's point, to get your users to a point where they can access the resources in a very simple way that's secure, right? Because I think, you know, moving towards simplicity is always good for humans, and it's also always good for system configuration, right? Because the more complex your system configuration is, the harder it is to audit, right? To make sure things like those S3 buckets aren't publicly readable and writable. Right? If you didn't intend them to be that way. So I guess I really wanted to mention that sometimes organizations actually have to take a hard line on burning down, not incurring technical debt moving forward from a specific point that they made a decision, and then burning down all that technical debt that's related to security from that point backwards, right? So for example, our first episode, right, we talked about cloud adoption and security. And, you know, I think it's relevant in this conversation to talk about, you know, how can an organization within the DoD to kind of get back to, you know, our focus of the military applying, you know, contemporary technologies to help them become more secure, more highly available. I really want to kind of mention that an organization outside of all the technical things we're talking about actually has to put that flag in the sand and say, okay, from this point forward, we're going to make some architectural tenants. And by tenants, I don't mean it in the terms of like a Microsoft tenant from a technical perspective, but like a tenant, T-E-N-E-T, right? A tenant of my approach. So for example, what I'm trying to say here is that if you decide moving forward that you are going to adopt a cloud technology stack, and that's what you want your model to be because you do not want to build on-premises data centers or expand the applications with them, within them, or the hardware within them, you actually have to tell your organization, hey, from this point forward, the systems that are going to be built to process systems and applications that are going to be built to process this type of data can be done in a cloud or a hyperconverged environment, right? And then in order to make that a zero trust type architecture, here are the principles or the architectural decisions you will adhere by as an organization when you build, right? Meaning a good example of that would be, you know, if I'm architecting in Microsoft, right? Maybe a container that I put, and I say this container not as containerization technologies, but maybe I put every app in its own tenant, right? That might be wickedly hard, right? Maybe that's too big of a bucket. But maybe each app lives in its own VNet if I'm using the Microsoft model. If I'm using the Amazon model, maybe each app lives in its own virtual private network, right? By VNet, virtual network, virtual private network, virtual private cloud on the Amazon side of the house, right? So my point is, without getting into all the technologies that I'm kind of ranting about here, I think organizations need to actually make some fundamental policy decisions that help their application owners, or more importantly, just their builders writ large, get to a point that they can take action in order to get to a more zero trust type like architecture. And that's non-trivial. So Kyle, John, I don't know what you guys' thoughts are there, but I think if we don't start taking action by placing a flag in the sand, we never really step off, right? The military, the Marine Corps likes to step off on the left foot because it's the best foot. But
best foot.
Mighty, yeah. Mighty.
But go ahead.
Yeah, I think you made up a good point there. We there's a few ways to get started with this. And if I was going to, if I had a customer come to me and say, how do I do this? Where do I start? I would just say, get a microservice-based architecture, right? Like software-defined microservices, and begin there. And even if you only have one application that you pull out to, draw the first step into the sand of building a microservice architecture, break one thing out of your monolith. And then once you have that microservice architecture, understand your risk levels and create a device inventory, right? Like figure out how you're going to identify a specific identity and a specific device across your network. And once you have those three things, right? Microservices, identity service, that identification service, that additional microservice that just helps you identify things, and strong authentication mechanisms. That's all you really need to get the primer going. And then it just simply becomes a matter of how many things are you breaking off your monolith and dropping into this new authentication method. And it can all exist alongside your existing traditional VPN technology and traditional firewall stuff until you're ready to roll it. And it's not super hard. Let me take that back. I'm not going to say it's not super hard, right? It's technically not super hard. Organizationally, culturally, business process wise, that stuff's much more difficult than the technical sides of these things. John?
Yeah, no, I, Kyle, you got it dead on. And I would just say, take something low impact, take something low density, so it's not super important and it's not a whole lot of people running on it. Like a bad idea would be to, like, for instance, start with all your VIPs, your C-suite people. Like, don't do that. Low impact, low density. And the other thing is let it run for a little bit and learn a little bit, because there's a bit of what we've been talking about here about diving in and whatever. But, to a certain degree, we got to stop and learn a bit. Just like you're all sitting here listening to this podcast to learn a little bit about security. Stop and learn a little bit about your applications and your users and how you access data and what that kind of looks like. And let it run in your environment for a bit. And think about how you're going to move forward from that point.
Totally. All right. Well, I know we're getting close on time, y'all, and I want to just drop a quick thing to say. Please go research this technology. If you're not familiar with it, go take a look. A simple search engine result for zero trust, getting started, BeyondCorp, et cetera, is going to give you way more content than you're going to want to consume. And this is not a simple concept to implement. You got to know a little bit about security, like John said, about applications, and like Rich said, a lot about your risk levels. But nothing's to stop you from doing this right now. You could set up a media server in your home and expose it through a cloud provider's identity aware proxy and have this functioning from your phone in a matter of a couple hours. It's not super difficult to do. You don't have to do it with heavy stakes, mission critical business apps just yet. Learn in low risk environments. That's a plus plus. And we know we didn't dive super deep into the tech stuff today because we just don't have enough hours in the day to get into actual implementation stuff of BeyondCorp, but get out there, learn a little more. This stuff's fun.
Absolutely. Rich, you have any last thoughts before I outro us?
Yeah, I just have one thing to say, right? So, we talked about how do we start, right? I think just understanding that what you're trying to do from a zero trust perspective is a lot like old school radio communications, where I have a signal that goes, up an antenna and then it pops off that antenna, right, out into, the atmosphere and transfers itself to another antenna. That's kind of what you're trying to do with a zero trust architecture, right? You're trying to get all of the security controls in place that you're comfortable with based upon the risk level that you have for that data or that application. And then you want to pop it off your corporate network in its own risk contained bubble in a cloud environment, if that's the model you choose to move towards. But totally agree, nothing is more important than actually getting educated in reading here, to kind of throw back to our last episode on MCDP7 learning. So that's what I have for today, gents.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much. And dear listeners, thanks for joining us. Just a reminder, you can connect with us on social media at USMC underscore @TFPhoenix. That's twitter.com/USMC_TFPhoenix. Again, thanks for joining us. And Rich and Kyle, thanks as always.
Absolutely. Stay safe, everybody.